January the 19th, 2009, Mr. President, your committee number 10, Labor, Health, and Social Services, to whom was referred Senate File 40, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass. I, Senators Hastert, Honeycutt, Landon, Schiffer, and Scott, Senator Scott, Chairman. January the 19th, 2009, Mr. President, your committee number 1, Judiciary, to whom was referred Senate File 19, reports back with a recommendation that it do pass, amended. Ayes, Senators Burns, DeCaria, Perkins, Ross, and Sessions, Senator Ross, Chairman. January the 29th, 2009, Mr. President, your committee number 1, Judiciary, to whom was referred Senate File 86, reports back with the recommendation that it do pass, amended. Aye, Senators Burns, DeCaria, Perkins, Ross, and Sessions, Senator Ross, Chairman. Hey, Bill.
Considerations of bills on general file. Oh, excuse me. Senator Scott.
Mr. President, Senate File 40 that was just read in, court-ordered placements, BOCES reimbursements, that shifts funds from, shifts in activity from one budget to another. It's a shift of funds. It doesn't have an appropriation in it now, Mr. President, but I'm going to ask it be re-referred to committee number 2 because I think it may need both an appropriation and a de-appropriation is that to reflect the shift in the funding.
Okay. Senate File 40 will be reassigned to Committee Number 2, Appropriations, without objections, if there's no objection. Okay, Mr. Majority Floor Leader, we have that order of business, consideration of bills on general file.
Mr. President, I move that the Senate resolve itself back into the Committee of the Whole.
You've heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senator Jennings.
We have a quorum. Committee of the Whole, come to order. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 29. The clerk, please read the bill.
Senate File Number 29, sponsored by Senator Geis, Increased Industrial Road Program Limits, an act relating to the Industrial Road Program. It was referred to Committee Number 3, Revenue, which reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Case, Larson, Martin, Perkins, and Schiffer, Senator Schiffer, Chairman.
You've heard the bill. What's your pleasure, Senator Schiffer?
Mr. Chairman, I move in the Committee of the Whole rise and report it do so with the due pass recommendation on Senate File 29, Increased Industrial Road Program Limits, and I yield the floor to the prime sponsor, Senator Geis.
Senator Geis.
Mr. Chairman, all we're doing with this bill is it's the industrial road program, and what it does is the state puts up so much money and the counties can raise money to match it, and we're just moving it from $1 million to $2 million. And there's five ex-county commissioners on this floor and one ex-state highway commissioner, and they know a lot more about this bill than I do, so if you have any questions, you ask those ex-county commissioners, and they can tell you all about this bill.
Question being called for. All those in favor of Senator Schiffer's motion to about, excuse me, I have to find my script. All those in favor of Senator Schiffer's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 29, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Senate File 29 has passed Committee of the Whole. Next bill for our consideration is Senate File 12. Would the clerk please read the bill?
Senate File Number 12, sponsored by Senator Burns, Campaign Contributions, an Act Relating to Elections. It was referred to Committee Number 7, Corporation Elections, Political Subdivisions, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Case, Cooper, Johnson, Scott. No, Senator Hastert. Senator Case, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure, Senator Case?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a due pass recommendation on Senate File 12, campaign contributions. There are no amendments to this bill, and for an explanation, I'd like to yield to the sponsor, Senator Burns.
Senator Burns.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, this bill basically does the same thing that the last bill did, only instead of industrial roads, it deals with campaign contributions. Right now, that's in fact what it does. Right now, there is a difference. Any state candidate from the if somebody running for a seat on a improvement district, all the way up to the governor's office, the maximum donation that any individual can make per cycle is $1,000. And especially on the statewide basis, that is for the statewide elected officials to be able to try and run on a statewide campaign. Yet somebody who's running for Congress, they're set to the federal standards, which is $2,300. So, Mr. Chairman, what this bill does is it moves the state standards up from $1,000 up to $2,300. And, Mr. Chairman, if the difference between the federal and the state isn't enough, that $1,000 was actually, that limit was set in 1977. So inflation has taken it past the $2,300 in the meantime. And with that, I would entertain any questions on the bill.
Questions on the bill? Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Case's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 12, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Senate File 12 has passed Committee of the Whole. Next bill for our consideration is Senate File 33. Would the clerk please read the file?
Senate File Number 33, sponsored by Senator Martin, Public Easement Abandonment, an Act Relating to Public Easements. It was referred to Committee Number 3, Revenue, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Case, Larson, Martin, Perkins, and Schiffer. Senator Schiffer, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure, Senator Schiffer?
Mr. Chairman, I move in the Committee of the Whole rise to report, do so with a due pass recommendation on Senate File 33. Mr. Chairman, there is a standing committee amendment. I'd ask that it be read in at this time.
Senate File 33, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 1, line 7.
Mr. Chairman, I would move at this time the Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 and yield the floor to Senator Martin for an explanation.
Senator Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I bring this bill before you for a couple of reasons. Presently in the state, we have the situation where easements have been reserved for a street or public road for the public's use, but those easements never were conveyed to a local government and that would have had jurisdiction over those easements. It remains on a deed or title traveling from owner to owner. And in most instances, Mr. Chairman, the local government will not now accept the easement if it is conveyed to them. Or they're, the local government's not even aware that the easement is in existence. Presently, under this scenario, the only recourse that the owner of the Servient estate has is to be able to abandon the easement and clean up the title, is to take that through district court, which is costly and time-consuming. And if the easement has been conveyed and the local government accepts the easement, there is a process for local governments to follow if they wish to abandon the easement. But it is my understanding that the process for abandonment of an easement is not used consistently from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. Senate File 33 establishes a process for local governments to use whether they have or have not accepted the easement, but because it is in their jurisdiction, they then can follow the process and abandon the easement if it is felt that it's in the public's best interest. Mr. Chairman, that's a, just a quick explanation, but I would like to walk the body through the bill, if I could, sir. Starting on Section 1 on page 1, lines 7 and 8, it state that Wyoming Statute 1612-101 through 1612-102 are created to read. And page 1, lines 13 through 14, 1612-101 is abandonment of public easement, the authorization and definition. Subsection A on page 2, lines 1 through 4, states that the governing body of any city or town may abandon any public easement granted to the public within the incorporated boundaries of the city or town in the manner provided in this chapter. And subsection B, page 2, lines 6 through 8, grants the same provision that was in subsection A to a county. The committee, as part of the amendment, the committee added language which states that the abandonment of a public easement under this chapter shall not impair the right of any public utility to continue to operate and maintain utility facilities within the public easement. Subsection C, page 2, lines 10 through 13, defines the governing body. And 1612-102, page 2, lines 15 through 16, is abandonment of easement. Hearing notice and how the hearing will be conducted, the order, and the recording of the proceedings. Subsection A, page 2, lines 18 through 24, and page 3, lines 1 through 23, page 4, lines 1 through 2, states that if the governing body of any city or town for public easements within the incorporated area of the city or town, or the governing body of the county for easements in unincorporated areas in the county, considers it to be in the public's interest to abandon any easement within their jurisdiction, the governing body shall set a time and place for a public hearing upon the proposal to abandon the easement. Page 3, lines 1 through 7, the committee added new language which states, after providing notice to the Public Service Commission, a notice of the hearing shall be published for 3 consecutive weeks prior to the hearing in a newspaper published in the county in which the easement is located. Page 3, line 8, after hearing, the committee deleted the comma and inserted and. And then added a period after abandonment on line 9 and deleted the remainder of that line. And deleted lines 10 through line 18, ending with the word of abandonment. On page 3, the end of line 18 and through the middle of line 20, that states that any resident may appear at the hearing and offer evidence in support of or opposition of the proposed amendment. The previous deletion stated that the person who may be contesting the abandonment of the easement had to file 10 days in advance, but it allowed anybody else to come and speak to the proposal if they were in agreement with the abandonment, which set up an unfair situation. And that's why the committee chose to delete that language that I mentioned earlier. The remainder of line 20 through line 23 on page 4, lines 1 and 2, states that the governing body determines that it is in the public's interest. The governing body may order the easement abandoned by ordinance or resolution. Subsection B on page 4, lines 4 through 15, states that if no substantial use has been made of a public easement for a period of at least 10 consecutive years, and the easement has not been maintained by the city or town or county, it will be deemed that the governing body has intended to abandon the public easement. Page 4, lines 16 through 24, states that the owner of the Servian estate may notify the governing body where the easement is located of the expiration of the 10-year period of non-use or maintenance, and can demand that the governing body initiate the hearing process that was specified in subsection A. Page 5, lines 1 through 19, simply reaffirms the hearing process when the governing body determines that the easement has no substantial use or maintenance of the easement for 10 consecutive years, and the governing body may, and which the committee changed it from shall, order public easement abandoned by ordinance or resolution. In subsection C on page 5, lines 21 through 24, and page 6, lines 1 through 3, states that the record of the proceedings of the public hearing, including the findings of the governing body, shall be made part of the minutes of the regular or special meeting of the governing body, and that the final order to abandon the easement in the real estate records of the county clerk and the recorder's office in which the abandoned easement is located. And finally, the committee deleted page on page 6, lines 5 through 11, the new Wyoming statute 16-12-103. It was redundant to have that information in there simply because we're going through the process of abandoning that. And what that stated was simply that the city, town, or county, once this is abandoned, they would not be maintaining the road. With that, Mr. Chairman, I would be glad to answer any questions.
Senator Martin, did you want to go over the amendment?
Pardon me?
Did you want to go over the amendment, Senator Martin? That was the amendment. Okay. Senator Honeycutt.
Mr. Chairman, could the senator go over that part on page 3 again about the PSC?
Therefore, we need to deal with the amendment before we go into the bill.
Mr. Chairman, the concerning the PSC, the idea behind that, Mr. Chairman, was that often in rural areas there's pipelines that may not have been identified, and the prudent report that is abandoned to
any other questions on the standing committee amendment? Senator Sessions.
Mr. Chairman, I've just been sitting here thinking, explain to me what happens when you have an easement that gives rights to public access to state or federal land. I don't know. I don't understand how this fits into that at all, or if it even does.
Senator Schiffer.
Mr. Chairman, in response to that question, you can give an easement. Whoever owns the surface can give an easement that allows access to state or federal ground. What this bill deals with is who gets the easement, who holds the easement. And you can get any number of people to hold an easement. But what it deals with is where it went to a public entity and they never took it. In other words, it's just sitting there. You know, I can give an easement to a to an oil company, and I can make it an easement for a road, and the oil company can use that road and maybe go to a state section or something. I can also give an easement to the county for a road, and it may allow access to state or federal land, in which case the county holds the easement. This is those cases. You know, for lack of a better word, you got to call them orphan easements. They've been granted, but no public entity has ever picked them up or developed them or done anything with them. And sometimes they don't even know they have them, quite frankly. So it does not impair any easement that say a county's picked up and run a county road to it. They're still there and they'll still be the same.
Question being called on the amendment. Are you ready? Are all those in favor of Senator Schiffer's motion to adopt the standing committee amendment number one, please say aye.
Aye.
Back on the bill. Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I worked for Laramie County for many years, and several times each year, request to abandon a public easement would come before the commissioners, and since everybody was in favor of it, they dutifully approved of it. I'm wondering if anybody checked current statutes on that and see if there's any repealers that we have to put in so that this would have the effect and wouldn't cross any other laws.
Senator Martin.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I at this point in time, I haven't looked at that. LSO drafted this, and it actually sets up a new chapter and to deal with the abandonment of easements. But that's something I could check into, and if this passes today, come back on second reading and give you an answer, or get with you and give you an answer.
Senator Johnson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be very happy. I know who to get a hold of to find out what statutes they're working under currently.
Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman. I had the same concern as was expressed earlier about access to state land and other public land. And I just want to make sure, my understanding is this applies to easements that have been recorded as being granted to a city or a county, and they never accepted them, so they really don't have any responsibility for them. But am I right in thinking that this does not apply to an easement that would, say, granted to the Game and Fish or granted to some sportsman's organization or somebody else like that that might have gone out and gotten an easement so they could get access to the public lands? Is that a correct understanding of the bill?
Senator Schiffer.
Mr. Chairman, my colleague from Natrona County is absolutely right. For example, a Game and Fish easement, where people are using it to access it for whatever recreation they're doing. By virtue of people using it, it would not fall under this act. They've used it to develop their whatever they're doing out there, hunting or fishing or, you know, whatever it's for. That's separate from what this is. This is where there's been non-use. They have not developed a road or a program or a walking trail, all the stuff they use them for. This is when they haven't used them. What you find is that there are easements out there that are granted But the local government or the Game and Fish or the City Parks Department hasn't even picked them up. They're just out there, and they have not used them. They're just sitting. And if they've sat there for at least 10 years and no public entity has picked them up and developed them or developed walk-in hunting or whatever it is, then this is a method where you can go without going to court, that you can go and say, okay, I'd like to have this easement given back to the surface owner. Understand right now that if that happens, you can always go to court, petition the district court. Quite frankly, because this is a civil matter, you pick which district court you want. If you're in one I happen to know about, if you're in Campbell County right now and say, I'm going to file a civil matter, you're probably looking at 2,000, about somewhere between 15 and 18 months before it even gets on the docket. This is a way that says we're going to inform the public, here's the process, and we're going to eliminate something that isn't being used. The option is always still out there. You can go to court. But this streamlines it. It makes it a little bit simpler. And how many lawyers we got left in here? It makes it a lot cheaper to do. You don't have to hire. But when we do hire them, they do great work. Great work. That's what it is.
Senator Scott?
Okay. I understand that this is supposed to be used only for the ones that are being unused. I would think that some of the public access easements wouldn't require much real development. You just got to be able to walk, step over the fence and walk there. Are the notification procedures such that the word will get out so that somebody who is using it has an opportunity to object before it gets abandoned?
Senator Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The notification, as I mentioned, would be, first you would have the notification to the Public Service Commission, and then the notice would be published for 3 consecutive weeks in the in a newspaper in the county where that jurisdiction was. Or if there's not a newspaper that has that sort of circulation, it would be in a statewide newspaper, which you would hope that people would pick up on it at that time.
Senator Larson.
Chairman, we had kind of this question come up in committee, and I might suggest that I think what you're really talking about is more of a prescriptive easement where somebody has used it. It could have been a long time ago, deeded, not deeded, and that's the point. It was one that no one knew about that's there, that there could be some hunters and fishermen or whatever who want to use that. Or there could be instances of a prescriptive easement, which I think that's 10 years, not an attorney, but they've been using all the time anyway, which comes into a different area, I believe. This is designed predominantly for government entities who have been granted something that many of them don't even know they have. I could not say that a hunter or a fisherman hadn't used it. I think that would fall, however, in the notification process if anybody's watching. Do they have a requirement to go and notify anybody that's ever gone across that easement? Probably not. But I think the word would get out if it's used very much by sportsmen or anybody else by the publication method.
Senator Scott.
Chairman. I'm And the bill makes all kinds of sense to me. I think it's something we need to do. I'm debating in my mind, should we add to the Public Service Commission and getting the notification, should we add the Game and Fish? And I think that would be an additional protection. On the other hand, I've seen the Game and Fish on some occasions in history just routinely object to everything. And that makes me wonder whether it'd be a good idea to add them to that list. So maybe there's a better way to get at that. You don't want to have to notify anybody who might ever have used it. That makes it impossible. You don't want to notify a state agency if they just have a rubber stamp that says no. Maybe there's some other way to reach that particular problem.
Additional comments on the bill? Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Schiffer's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 33, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Senate File 33 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next Senate file for consideration, Senate File 7. Would the clerk please read the file?
Senate File Number 7, sponsored by the Travel Committee, Historic Mine Trail and Byway Program, an act relating to the Wyoming Historic Mine Trail and Byway System. It was referred to Committee Number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, Cole, Dockstader, Jennings, and Session. Senator Burns, Chairman.
You've heard the bill. What's your pleasure, Senator Burns?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a favorable recommendation for Senate File 7, Historic Mine Trail and Byway Program. There are no amendments nor appropriations on the bill. And for further explanation, I would ask you to call on the new senator from Star Valley.
Be Senator Dockstader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the Senate, Senate File 7 allows the state to maintain a program that's called Wyoming Historic Mine Trail and Byway System. This was established by a previous session of the Senate back in 2005, and it was a project of the late senator from Fremont County. Now, as noted on page 2, lines 3 through 9, the new legislation eliminates the need for a commission to have oversight of the trail and byway system, but the authority for the system will now be handled by the Department of State Parks and Cultural Resources. This will be folded into the Monument Markers Program within that department. This is logical, allowing for the same form and application process. For Historic Mines and Trails Monument, they'll go through the same application process, allows redundancy on the website. This will be a smoother process for all local projects, because it simply simplifies everything. With that transfer, there are no additional funds required. As noted in your fiscal note, the bill does not modify any state agency budget or current personnel authorizations. It simply transfers it from one unit to another. Again, it simplifies the process. Section 3 on page 3 acknowledges the transfer of duties, funds, existing contracts or agreements, and policies. In summary, this streamlines the process and makes it more efficient while still maintaining the original intent of the late senator from Fremont County. I would urge your favorable consideration. Thank you.
Questions on the bill? Senator Schiffer.
Mr. Chairman, would the sponsors of the bill tell us what all is contained in Section 2?
Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, Section 2 is a repealer, and it repeals the original formation of the makeup of the commission itself. And the problem with the legislation as it was standing before, and I believe the current senator from Fremont County was appointed to that commission at one point. It was a large and burdensome commission to do what it was supposed to do, and just getting people appointed to it and getting the schedules all juggled to accomplish its purpose is done, can be done much better by the department, which is why we brought the this particular piece of legislation. But Section 2 is the repealer, where it lays out who was to be appointed to the commission, how long. You know, it was that type of language where it'd be a representative from such and such, and a representative from such and such, and a representative from such and such. I believe there were about 14 or 15 people appointed to this commission.
President Hines.
Mr. Chairman, I had a question there on page 2 when in the paragraph B where you was deleting some of the things that the commission was created to do. And I'm wondering, does this just now applies to these areas that is listed there and located in Fremont County, or could this system be anywhere, a different system in Wyoming? It looked like to me now we're just limited to one system in Fremont County. Is that right, or am I interpreting it wrong?
Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, that language that the President of the Senate points to is actually old language. That's the old original language. And that particular trail, that trail and byway, was established by the commission and has done nothing since. And I think his point is well taken, that if we don't delete that additional language there, it may only limit it to the areas listed in the statute. And I thank him for pointing that out, and I'll be bringing a second reading amendment to delete that language, or with an explanation of why it would should still be in there.
Additional discussion on the bill? Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Burns' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 7, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Senate File 7 has passed Committee of the Whole. Our next file, Senate file for consideration, Senate File 2. Would the clerk please read the file?
Senate File 2, sponsored by the Corporations Committee, Insurance, Financial Reporting Requirements, and Act Relating to Insurance Companies. It was referred to Committee Number 7, Corporation Election Political Subdivisions, who reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Case, Cooper, Hastert, and Johnson. No, Senator Scott. Senator Case, Chairman.
I've heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure, Senator Case?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Mr. Chairman, I would move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, it do so with a due pass recommendation on Senate File 2. There is a standing committee amendment. If we could have that read in at this time, please.
Senate File 2, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1, page 2, line 21.
Mr. Chairman, I would move Standing Committee Amendment Number, Committee of the Whole Amendment Number 1 to Senate File 2. It's just a little bit of cleanup language, and let's just maybe take care of that right up front. If you look, all it does is on page 2, line 21, changes the word such to those. Page 4, line 24, it adds a comma after the word system. Page 5, line 19, we change such to the word the. Page 7, line 8, that deals with an effective date of the act, and you'll can see that it's kind of redundant because it has on pages lines 8 and 9, it says the requirements of this section shall be in effect beginning January 1st, 2010. Well, Mr. Chairman, that's when the entire act is effective, is in January 1st, 2010, so that was redundant. There's a similar enactment clause on page 10, line 4, and we just deleted that line to avoid the redundancies. And then page 20, line 2, this was where it refers to the federal act. I think that's Sarbanes-Oxley, if I remember. And let me find it for just a second. Section 404, that's Sarbanes-Oxley Act. And we added the words, or subsequently enacted similar federal law. so that we wouldn't be stuck with one reference. That's the subject of the Standing Committee Amendment. Sure, everybody, there's no hidden zingers in here. It's very minor. It's just housekeeping. Let's take care of it up front. Call for the question if there's no more.
Questions on the amendment? Question being called on the amendment. All those in favor of Senator Case's motion to adopt the Standing Committee Amendment number 1 to Senate File 2, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Standing Committee Amendment number 1 has passed. Senator Case.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would now yield to fine Senator from Lincoln County, Senator Cooper.
Senator Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the Senate, Senate File 2, Insurance Financial Reporting Requirements. This is a bill that was the result of an assigned committee, assigned to the committee by the Management Council on Interim Committee Topics for us to work on. The audit laws has and deals with the audit laws for insurance companies, and these were originally adopted actually in the Wyoming statutes in 1994. However, this bill that we have before us today adds actually three new sections to the law and amends part of the current law, and it has a lot to do with the Sarbanes-Oxley law that we've already talked about here for a minute on the amendment. And as you know, there was a great deal of problems with a certain company in this country a few years back where the CEO of that company is now serving time in the big house. And so this kind of brings our Wyoming statutes up to date with that law. And also it's the committee heard testimony from several members of the associations in the insurance industry, and they were in total support of the proposed changes today that we're going to have be talking about on this bill. Another thing is the changes in the laws that we have today are important that we get these changes done during this legislative session. Can't even say it. In order to maintain our insurance department's accreditation with the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, the NAIC. And that's important for a couple of reasons. One of the reasons is that we have five domestic insurance companies in our state that operate here in Wyoming that are homegrown companies here. And at least one of those companies operates outside of the state of Wyoming, and it's probably the second largest domestic company we have here. And without us having our insurance department having this accreditation here in Wyoming, that company would have a difficult time operating in the other states that it currently operates in, because this NAIC accreditation is throughout the states of the United States. We also have 1,100 foreign or non-domestic corporations, I should call them, I guess, and alien corporations that also operate in our state, 1,100 of them. They are all subject to this law in the other states in which they operate, as well as they are here in Wyoming. And the commissioner has to be able to verify their compliance with this NAIC accreditation. The law currently requires each insurer to have an annual independent review of its financial statements by a CPA or an accounting firm. Senate File 2 provides three major additions, like I've mentioned before, to the insurance code, which includes the following three subjects. These are the three main subjects that this bill has to do with. One is auditor independence. And as you know from that corporation, that large corporation that had problems here in the United States not too many years ago, had a very tough problem with that because they had an auditor that was not only auditing their books, but also was acting as a consultant to the corporation, which caused a great deal of problem. Second part of it is corporate responsibility and governance. They want to make sure that the management in those corporations are totally aware of not only the independence of their auditing team, but also the responsibility for reporting financial reporting to the company. And this third one is internal control over financial reporting. They want to make sure that there's a method for testing, that there's all kinds of methods that are in place within those insurance corporations to be able to test the operations of the financial reporting in those companies. Now I'll go through the bill. It's a pretty lengthy bill. It's about 35 pages long, and I'll try to go through this and be as accurate as possible as I go through the bill. But I'm going to just hit each of the sections and tell you what it's about. On page 1, lines 10, 11, and 11, in section 1, identifies the three sections being added to the code. In other words, it lists them by number. It tells you where we're adding these three sections. Section 26.3.315 lists all the requirements for the audit committee. And these corporations will now, insurers, I should say, will now have to have an independent audit committee, okay, to be able to work with the CPA or the accounting firm. Also on page 1, lines 13 through 16, and page 2, lines 1 through 6, in section A, this section spells out the responsibility of the audit committee for hiring and directing the work of the CPA. And as we go through this, you'll see why that's so important, that they may remain independent, because they want to have, you know, very little influence, I guess, from the management people as to their independence. And B, little b, in that same section, identifies the makeup of the audit committee, who they are. And C, little c, defines the requirements of an independent member of the audit committee and certain conditions to participate if the member is a non-independent. Independent members are generally are members who are members of the, and I won't go into a lot of detail on this, but you can ask me later about it, are members of the corporate board. Non-independents are usually people who are a member of the management of the company. And D, little d, gives the replacement time parameters for a committee member that ceases to become independent. Little e, this section is all about the holding companies and the controlling person or person being a corporation. Or a corporation and the requirement to notify the commissioners of an election to have one audit committee to represent all of its subsidiary companies. F is timely reporting of the audit by the CPA to the committee and identifies a statement on auditing standards in 61 as the reporting guideline, and those who are auditors or accountants in here would understand that. Little I, little 1I, little 2I, and little 3I is the audit reporting requirements for the accountant, what he has to do is for the audit. Little G is the aggregate reporting for insurers that are members of the holding company system, and H is the proportional criteria for the audit committee membership and the commissioner's authority to require changes to the membership if the insurer is in an RBC action or financial trouble. RBC action, members of the Senate, stands for risk-based capital, and that's a very important part of the insurance business because that tells the commissioner that they have a certain amount of capital available to handle the risk that they're insuring out there. And that's a very important part of the insurance industry, as I understand it. Little I, 1I, 2I, 3I, talks about the total amount of premiums an insurer has and will determine the required structure of the audit committee membership. It also defines what premiums are to be calculated. J and identifies exclusion and waivers for federal insurance programs. If you have a whole lot of flood insurance programs and so forth in your portfolio and premiums, they can be excluded from this because they're a special case because they're backed by the federal government. Foreign and alien insurers are exempt, as in K. M talks about the insurers who must comply with the independent requirements. And then moving on to 26.3.3.16. Now, this is the section that deals with corporate responsibility and for governance. And section little a, 1 and 2, is what the responsibilities of corporate offices are. B and little 1I, 2I, 3I, and 4 is the corporate office will take no action to coerce the accountant, and that's pretty important. There's a lot of stipulations in there, kind of laundry list of things that the management team cannot do to try to coerce the accountant who's doing the audit. C is the general state statutes for criminal and civil penalties and what they are. Now moving on to section 26.3.17. Now this is the section that covers the new internal control requirements, also important. A covers the requirement to prepare a report The insurer's internal control over financial reporting on a yearly basis. You have to actually identify what controls you actually have in place for those for reporting, financial reporting within that company. You have to tell the commissioner, explain to him what those controls are. And later on, you'll see here also where they not only have to tell them what they are, but they have to show where they've tested them and that they work. Gives commissioners the ability to require a report of internal control from the insurer regardless of the premium threshold if an RBC event happens or hazardous financial thing. That means that if you have a problem, if you have an event where your risk-based capital is going down, you don't have enough to cover the risk, or you have some other financial hazardous condition which is listed in the statutes. There's like two pages in the statutes of what a financial or hazardous financial condition is for the commissioner to look at. C gives the insurers, talks about SOX. SOX is the Sarbanes-Oxley law, federal law. And if you're in compliance with that, it's very important with this, and particularly Section 404 of Sarbanes-Oxley, then you don't have to fill out and do all these reports because your reports all been done under the SOX rules. D talks about, gives a laundry list of what has to be in your internal control report. And E requires management to document the basis for which is able to monitor and, like I said before, test what these controls are within your corporation or company. E requires management. Oh, I said it. F gives the insurer until January 1, 2010 to implement the requirements of the section. And the reason that was we go all the way out to January 1, 2010, because the industry had complained to the SOX people that they weren't able to implement this stuff as quick as they thought they could, and there was a great deal of expense involved and so forth. And so the time now has basically been set for January 1, 2010 for the implementation of this. Section 2 lists the amendments of the section of the preceding statutes. So now we've gotten all the way through all three of those items I told you about before that we're adding to the statute. Now we're getting into this section from 26.3.301 on, or just amendments to statutes that are already on the books. A in 26.301 is just a change in the word to and, which means you have to meet both of the criteria now in that section, and they just merely change directly to direct. B is just cleanup language. C deletes the old terminology and just adds the new terminology that's in existence today. I adds the new name of the Canadian regulators, have changed the name of their regulators, so that's been changed. D is the exemption clause for internal control reporting for foreign and alien insurers. Foreign insurers are those, anybody who is not listed in Wyoming as a Wyoming corporation, so that's anybody that's not only in another state, but also could be in a foreign country. An alien company is a company who is totally out of the United States in another, I want to say world, but another country. 26, exemption clause of the internal control reporting for foreign alien corporations said that section 26.3.302 is just the definitions, and all these definitions have been added are just simply new definitions that have been added because of the three sections been added. 26.3.303 is general requirements related to filing and extension of filings. These are just rules that talk about how you can ask and be granted an extension because you have various problems with trying to be able to meet the actual date. Usually these are always set to somewhere around 30 to 90 days. Section 26.306 is qualifications for an independent CPA. Just exactly what is an independent CPA. C is the purpose of the amendment is to provide fresh eyes for reviewing. Now, this is very important. There's a requirement in 26.3.306 that talks about the fact that every 5 years you have to change the members of the CPA firm, has to change the people that are reviewing the audit, okay? And the reason that is because they want to have fresh eyes on this thing. Every 5 years, they want you to change. So that particularly, so that, you know, you don't have one or few auditing people always getting too used to, too close. So what's the word am I trying to think of? Too close to that insurer or that corporation, so they can become, I'm going to say buddy buddies, but that maybe that's not the word, the words, but the, you know, too close to them. So by requiring this change every 5 years, you're going to get some new people in there to do the audit. And then D is just cleanup language. E is emphasize the independent CPA again. They want to emphasize, if you see the word, that the CPA must be independent. G, wow, there's a whole laundry list of things here too. All those sections under G are quite lengthy. This section all provides a laundry list of items that commissioners shall be required to reject the report. For example, if you have an auditor that's working for you, but on the side you say to him, oh, by the way, while you're doing the audit, how about doing some of this consulting work for us? We have some other problems out here. Well, and the fact of the matter is, if the commissioner that's identified to the commissioner can actually reject the entire financial report for that insurer. H covers exemption requests for Section G for insurers. J provides a list of exclusions for Section G. And K, this is just an oversight clause for the audit committee, says that all accounting services will be pre-approved. In other words, as I mentioned before, if you're going to do anything more than just a financial audit for this corporation, sure, you have to get permission to do these other things from the audit committee, or you won't be able to do them. And there's a lot of issues there that you will not be able to do. M is just a delegation of authority to grant pre-approvals by the committee, and N is just the audit committee conflict of interest clause for certain corporate officers. Section 263308 is the scope of the audit and report of an independent CPA, and then there's a whole bunch of cleanup language and national standards, a whole bunch of new national standards in that sections that they have to go by. 263309 is cleanup. 263310 is communications of the internal control related matters. And this kind of is bringing language up to date, requiring a report of any unremediated material weaknesses in the insurer's internal financial control report. In other words, you're expected, if the auditor finds things that are weaknesses within your control systems within your company for financial reporting, then you need to send a report to the commissioner and tell them that. And tell them what you're also going to do about it, fixing it. 26.312 is just cleanup again. 26.313 is exemptions and effective dates. 314 is the Canadian British companies cleanup under that section. And then 26.341.10 is the annual report, which brings this section, all that does just brings the section numbers up to date and the changes in this bill, and it tells them. And then there's a repealer in Section 3 that basically just gets rid of an old couple of clauses, A, B, and C there in that section that says there was a date in there of 1993 when there were certain things that had to be done. Well, we're already past 1993, and we're many years past it. And so from now on, you know, those things just need to be repealed because they were no longer used in the law. Folks, that's it. Stand for questions.
Thank you, Senator Cooper. Senator Bebout.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one question, and I understand the correlation between this and the Sarbanes-Oxley legislation and law now. Are we in any way, shape, or form going to require anybody that might come under this set of our statutes as an insurance company that reports to the SEC and then have them do something different than they already do, i.e., do we have any duplication requirements? Because obviously what they have to do to the SEC under the Sarbanes-Oxley as a public company is stringent enough. We're not asking for any more than that.
Senator Cooper.
Mr. Chairman, the answer to that is no. Actually, if you're now performing under the Sarbanes-Oxley, get that right. Let me call it SOX laws, and you're compliant with those, and you've done your reporting under Section 404, that you're actually exempted from this, that you can actually use that report to be able to apply that to your reporting to the commissioner. So you can use the same. So there's no duplication whatsoever. You can use that. Is that your
question? Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, I was a no vote in committee, and let me explain why. I was concerned about this because it does appear to be a mini Sarbanes-Oxley with regard to insurance. And I've heard a lot of criticism of Sarbanes-Oxley. It does seem to have had some very adverse effects. It's probably an overreaction, classic legislative overreaction to a problem. We were assured in committee that they had removed the problems. They'd made enough exceptions that we weren't going to cause the kind of problems for insurance companies that Sarbanes-Oxley has caused generally. Whether or not that's entirely true, I'm not quite sure, but they seem to have at least made an effort. The problem I had with the bill then was, frankly, I don't think it's very well done. It was looked at in the interim, and you can see evidence of that on page 5, where Model Act, NAIC Model Act, has a 3-tier system for which company has to do what. This has a 2-tier system that got modified in the interim committee. But there are a number of problems, duplications, poor wording. We corrected a few of them in the standing committee amendment. They were more extensive than you can deal with in a standing committee during session. I call your attention. I think the provision on page 21, starting at line 11, is a duplication of what's there earlier. There's a provision on page 11 with regard to material processes that, frankly, I can't understand. There's a set of provisions on page 8 that my notes are that they're vague and poorly written and difficult to understand. There's a good deal of that all through this bill, and that's why I voted no. We've had problems over the years with NAIC model legislation. It tends not to be very well done. I've personally brought one of their poorly done bills into House Corporations once, and Chairman McMillan handed me my head in a platter, and we came back next year after curing it. This is not as bad as that particular one was. Those were in the days I think they were paying the attorneys by the pound when they wrote them. But it's not a particularly well-done piece of legislation. We've got two choices. We can put it to sleep and bring back a cured-up version next year, or we can go ahead and pass it. I will represent to you that I think if we pass it, we won't do tremendous substantive harm, I don't think. And our insurance code is full of some monuments that indicate that that's the kind of action we've taken in the past sometimes. Some of that stuff is pretty darn hard to understand. But I thought this one, we could take the time to get it right. But it's really up to the Senate. Is it worth the expenditure of our time? Because it is not a particularly well-done bill.
Senator Case.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't claim authorship, but this was a interim committee bill. Your interim corporations committee worked on it hard. Not all the members of the committee were able to be at all the interim committee meetings, and that actually lies some of the source of the rub here. But we did modify the bill during the interim committee meetings, and in fact, of all the insurance companies that came to testify, they all support this bill. So let's talk about, you know, is it overregulating and overreaching? I don't know. In a year of the failure of failure of very large insurance companies in this nation, and scrutiny of financial assets, and the safety of insurance products sold to our citizens, you know, maybe it is a little bit better to have a little bit more regulation. The insurance companies all support this bill. because they operate in several jurisdictions, and they need uniformity. That's why you need a national model law. The one place where we deviated from the national model law is the one place that the insurance companies, at least one of them, had a problem, and they would like to see it change back to the three-tiered system. We left it at the two-tiered system in committee. Could it be better written? You know, I'll bet you it could. The Standing Committee Amendment helped with some of that. The amendments offered during the interim helped with some of that. We need this for our citizens. It tightens up regulations, and the insured people that are getting regulated support it. Your insurance commissioner supports it, and your committee supports it, with the exception of one member.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would strongly urge you to support this piece of legislation. In this environment that we have nationally, we have some of it statewide, quite frankly, the last thing we need to do is be under-regulating. And let's be very clear. Insurance companies collect huge amounts of money from the public. We do not want an insurance company in the state of Wyoming to not be successful and go down and have people's finances go down with them. There has been some nationally. We have not yet had any in Wyoming. But the requirements put into this bill relative to auditing, I think, are absolutely critical. They're no different than is done in the banking industry. Even some of the small ones have to have what we refer to as outside auditors and auditing committees. I can't tell you how strongly I feel about that. As a member of an outside auditing committee for over 20 years on a financial institution, if you don't have outside auditing, folks, I'm sorry, but you don't have much auditing. It's very easy to get somebody to come in and do your books and say they're an auditor and do it. You need someone that is not involved directly with management. And this bill does that. Insurance companies are depositories for an awful lot of money from the people of the state of Wyoming. And I don't want to see one like we've had on the national, AIG. Well, I shouldn't mention names here, but you know what they are. And there are several of them. The insurance commissioner recommends it. The companies that are even being there are recommending it. Could it be better written? I've never seen a bill that couldn't be better written. But we did a lot of work on this on the interim. At three meetings, at least, that I'm aware of, I think we made it better. I think we took out all of the main objections to it and do not pass it at this time with what we have going on in the financial and insurance industries right now. I think would be really bad for the state of Wyoming. And so I would urge your support of this bill. If there are some things that the good senator from Natrona County, who wasn't at the meetings, wishes to correct on it, I'm happy to work with or talk about it. But we need the bill, folks. We really need the bill, particularly in this economic and financial climate. So I would urge you to vote in favor of it.
Senator Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, we could, as was mentioned earlier, we could probably argue about the wording and some of this bill being more sophisticated. And I couldn't agree more with the good senator from Natrona County that there is some places definitely in here. He's heard me say, I think I've even commented to him personally that, well, there's some areas in here that, you know, the wording could be maybe later. However, I do agree with the good senator from Teton County that we really do need this bill. We need the accreditation for our department for a couple of different reasons. We need it for the consumers. We need it for the consumer protection. And we need it for the industry. We need it for the industry credibility that's out there because of what was mentioned just a few minutes ago from the good senator from Teton County and also the good senator from Fremont County. We need it. We need it because of the problems that they're having in that industry now. They need to be buoyed up, and they will be buoyed up by this. And I believe this is why they're all in favor of this, of getting this in place, because of this reaction that we've had by the public with all these industries going down here, in the insurance industry in particular, in our country. With that, Mr. Chairman, I would urge your favorable vote.
Any more discussion on the bill? Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Case's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 2, please say aye.
Aye.
Those against, nay. Senate File 2 is passed Committee of the Whole. The next Senate file for consideration is Senate File 35.
Senate File number 35, sponsored by Senator Sessions, Youth Access to Tobacco Cessation Program, and Act Relating to the Age of Majority and Health Care. It was referred to Committee number 4, Education, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Coe, DeCarrier, Jennings, Massey, Von Fladern, Senator Coe, Chairman.
You heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure, Senator Coe?
Chairman, I'm moving the Committee of the Whole rise and report it do so with a do pass recommendation on Senate File 35. For an explanation of the Senate file, I defer to Senator Sessions.
Senator Sessions.
Mr. Chairman, this is a very simple bill. What it does is, as I passed out, I hope you've read the sheet that I passed out to you. It might save some questions in the matter of time, in the interest of time. What it does is it just allows the online smoking cessation program to be open to minors. At this point, they cannot give any kind of counseling or help to minors. And what that online cessation program involves is it's a call-in online program with specially trained people. They have at least a bachelor's degree and are trained specifically in counseling and behavior modification. If we do this bill, they will also be trained in specifics on how to deal with young people and how you talk to them and how you counsel them and how you possibly can get them to think about what they're doing. The thing that will happen in it is that there will be no personal contact, and there will be no nothing will be mailed out to them unless they request the printed material on how to quit smoking. There was quite a discussion on medication, and that was the first question that I had asked in looking at this. And there is absolutely no medication given, no vouchers given for medication of any kind, any of the stop smoking. And then the question was asked, well, what if the person does not tell the truth about their age when they're asked the series of questions? Well, the medication is never just mailed out to them. What it is a voucher is mailed out to them. They would have to present it to the pharmacist, and the pharmacists are very astute about looking at someone and asking questions and asking for identification, because that stuff is controlled. And with young people, I'm not saying that wouldn't be given, but it would have to be done under a prescription and a doctor's care. So I think I've said about enough, and I will answer any questions that you have.
Any questions on the bill? Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Coe's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 35, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Senate File 35 passes Committee of the Whole. Next file, Senate File for consideration, Senate File 76. Would the clerk please read the file?
Senate File number 76, sponsored by Senator Johnson, Snowplows, Emergency Lights, and Act Relating to Motor Vehicles. It was referred to Committee 4, Education, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Coe, DeCarrier, Jennings, Von Fladern, excuse Senator Massey, Senator Coe, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure, Senator Coe?
Chairman, I move when the Committee of the Whole rise and report to do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 76. And for an explanation of this blue light special, I defer to Senator Johnson.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm bringing Senate File 76 to you at the request of several snowplow drivers that I had long discussions with this past summer. Currently, what do you notice when you're going down a road and you see yellow strobe lights? Who has them? Wide and large loads have them. Construction equipment has them. Snow plows have them. And thousands of construction pickups have them going all over the roads, and probably anybody else that feels like having them. In a snowstorm, it's very hard to tell, or it could be very hard to tell, what that is with the yellow strobe lights up ahead of you or coming at you. If it's a snow plow or even a large and wide load, it's got its own mini blizzard, and you don't know what it is. Can't tell what it is. Now, snow plows drive, the optimum speed for a snow plow to sand a road is 40 miles an hour. And I don't know if many cars go and trucks go around 40 miles an hour, but that is a problem. They're taught to go 40 miles an hour, otherwise the sand doesn't do any good on the road. They don't lay enough of it down. And the other yellow lights that you could see, they could be going at any speed whatsoever. Now, the state to the south of us, immediately to the south of us, for decades has had a law that only snow plows can have blue lights. And I've driven in their mountains in winters, and I've been able to see the blue lights as I've driven up on them from behind or coming at them. And I know what that is, and I know what to expect. It's a snow plow, and it's moving slow, and there's probably a sanding machine behind it. I don't want to get too close to it because I could lose my windshield. The snowplow drivers that I talked to, what they really wanted was to have blue lights on their trucks rather than yellow strobes, because they know that it would probably be safer. Now, I hope you got this list right here. It says Senate File 76, 11909 Johnson. That is the events in one year, where vehicles hit snowplows. And it goes from July 26, 2007. I don't know what a snowplow is doing out then, but it must have been in use, to May 2, 2008. You can see all of the plows that were hit in Wyoming. And as one snowplow driver said in committee, you really have never been excited till you see a car coming up behind you sideways. So I asked YDOT if they could do a light study to see if they could use something besides yellow. And after a couple, 3 weeks, they called back and they said, no, we don't have statutory permission. And I figured I would rather do that than micromanage saying that they had to use blue lights. Could they do a study and come up with which lights are best? Because the intensity of the strobes of the different colors can be very different. And also a lot, they can run the intensity up and down. They said they needed permission. So I had Senate File 76 written to give YDOT permission to check and see if they want to change the lights, to test it, to do a study rather than micro-enforcement. Now, law enforcement came in and kind of said they didn't like this because they use blue, but law enforcement I've seen on their bars, they have white, red, and blue strobes. It's a combination of them. That way you know it's law enforcement or it's an emergency vehicle such as a tow truck alongside the road loading a vehicle. What the snowplow drivers would like, and what I agree with, is if you see blue strobes coming at you, and blue strobes only, or you're pulling up on it, that's a snowplow, and they have to be treated differently because, again, they have the minor blizzard around them, and they're going 40 miles an hour at the most. So I would ask for your vote on Senate File 76, and I stand ready for questions.
Any questions on the bill? Senator Vasey.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, is the research say that blue lights are the most visible in the snow? Has there been research done as to what light might be the most visible?
Senator Johnson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I imagine the research has been done, and they'll go check it and then probably do their own research. As one of the members of the committee I went before said, if they do a study, it will be a thorough study. And the strobes, the action of the strobes, the intensity of the strobe lights can go up and down a scale no matter what the color of the light is.
Vice President Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Question. It seems to me that your testimony here today has been primarily directed towards blue lights, but the bill itself says blue, white, or amber. Could those not be confused then for law enforcement vehicles, which you indicated use blue, white, and amber?
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to give them the option of several, and I would expect them just to use one, as they are currently doing with the yellow strobes.
I'm sorry.
Mr. Chairman, I intentionally left out red.
Any additional discussion on the bill? Question being called on the bill. All those in favor of Senator Coe's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 76, please say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Senate File 76 is passed Committee of the Whole. Mr. Majority Floor Leader.
Mr. Chair, I move the Committee of the Whole beg leave to rise for the purpose of a 10-minute break and sit again.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
You're on a break.
You and your flu light special.
Thank you.
Amendment on Senate File 86, but I was going to hold it until we get to like about 70 to see how the progression of the day goes, because I don't want it out there if we don't need it.
Okay, and I don't plan on going any further. I held 85 off at request here, so
okay.
You know, we'll see. You know, was it 86? It's the last one.
Yeah, it's the last one. Yeah. That's why I thought I'd hold on the amendment just for a while.
Yeah, and if it looks like that, Bill's going to have a lot of debate, and there's going to be an amendment, and I may call a halt at just before that, like at 19, at the end of at 19.
Okay.
I'll go back and look at 86 again to see the what all that involves.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, you never know.
But you're right. That's right. I worry about everything I shouldn't worry about. And I bet you don't have any time to worry. Do you?
No.
I don't know what to talk about.
6. Will the reading clerk please read the bill?
He did turn it off. Yeah, it was off. Okay, now that the mic's on, everybody hear me? Committee of the Whole will please come to order. The first bill for our consideration is Senate File 6. Will the reading clerk will read the Senate file?
Senate File Number 6, sponsored by the Travel Committee, Wyoming Arts Council Revisions, an act relating to the Wyoming Arts Council. It was referred to Committee Number 6, Travel, Recreation, Wildlife, and Cultural Resources. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, Cole, Dockstader, Jennings, and Sessions. Senator Burns, Chairman.
Further reading the bill, what is your pleasure, Senator Burns?
Mr. Chairman, I move that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation for Senate File 6, Wyoming Arts Council Revisions. There are no amendments and there are no appropriations. And for a further explanation of the bill, I ask that you call on the good senator from Natrona County.
Senator Jennings.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Although this bill has a whole bunch of pages, it's fairly simple. It's taking the Wyoming Council on the Arts and making it the Wyoming Arts Council Board. And as you go through the bill, you'll see that that change has been made throughout the bill. And then that's the biggest thing that's going on. It also lets the new board, starting on page 3 and going on to 4, gives the responsibilities and the leeways of the board, work with the department to encourage and facilitate public interest in cultural heritage of the state and to expand the state's cultural resources, advise the department on program planning, policy formation, and fiscal responsibilities, participate in the development and review of long and short range plans, make recommendations to the governor for appointments to fill board vacancies and for appointments to the Cultural Trust Fund Board, make recommendations to the director of the department and administrator of the Division of Cultural Resources with the department on the selection of the manager of the Wyoming Arts Council Program, appoint committees and task force to carry out the duties deemed necessary by the board. Then it goes on to say that it will chair grant review committees or panels and approve the membership of grant review panels, consider recommendations of grant review committees and panels, review and recommend to the department a budget for the arts program and advise the department on allocation of state and federal funds, review and recommend art programs, approve guidelines for programs and oversee the art grant making functions of the department, actively promote and advocate for the arts throughout the state. As you go over to page 6, you're talking about how we're going to get money and assets in here, and you can see where the money received, the proceeds of other properties received under this subsection shall be deposited in a separate review account. And to expend it upon legislative appropriation for purposes of this article. It says the department may hold public hearings, enter into contracts for services and award grants, furthering the objectives of department arts program, and enter into contracts with local and regional associations for cooperation or cooperative endeavors, furthering the objectives for the department's art program. The department is designated as the official state agency for the purposes of receiving and disbursing any federal funds made available for purposes of this article. And as you go back through there, a lot more of the Council to Department article to sub-articles on page 8. You look at, get back to page 9. You can see where we've struck the language and shall be held in for a long time solely by the qualification organizations by the council on behalf of the qualifying organizations. This is how they're going to run the endowment fund. The department shall allocate monies from the state account to the endowment fund created by a qualifying organization under current statute 92907, determine the eligibility of each qualifying organization, determine the matching amount for each group, establish a date by which each qualifying organization shall provide its matching fund, verify that the matching funds have been provided in accordance with the Wyoming Administrative Procedure Act, establish criteria by rule, not otherwise prescribed in this article, for determining the eligibility of qualifying organizations to receive monies from the state account. And then as you go through, you can see that, again, it's council to departments through the rest of the bill. As you notice, there's a handout on your desk. Looks a lot like this one I have. And it gives you the list of groups that have already taken grants out of the fund, which now is empty, and moved them along. The first group there, you'll see that that is money that comes from all different levels. The second group on the bottom, that is state funds only. As you can see, this money has gone across the state. The state established different funds and endowments through grants and promotes everything on the arts and the council. It's a pretty easy bill to get through, even though it's got a lot of changes in it. I'd stand for any questions. I'd stand for any questions.
Further discussion on the bill, Senator Vasey.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. If the sponsor could explain to me why the Wyoming Arts Council, or whatever we change this name, has unlimited rulemaking authority through the administration procedure, and other constitutional established people have to question that, if you want.
Senator Jennings.
Mr. Chairman, because that's what they've asked for, and it's up to us to decide whether we're going to give it to them. You have some changes in the way they've been doing business here. They have rules in place already. If they have any rules that need to be changed, they want to go back and change them. If you don't want to give it to them, then let's take it out.
Chairman, it's not I don't want to give it to them. I just think certain ironies here just fly up in my face every once in a while, and we have a constitutional agency that has to jump through hoops to set, and then we have some Johnny-come-lately, and I have no problem with the Arts Council, but they seem to get unlimited rulemaking authority. Just a question.
Further discussion on the bill, Senator Larson.
I'd like to ask the committee or whomever to turn to page 4, go through lines 13 through 16. I have an objection to boards making recommendations to the governor to fill the board vacancies. That's what the governor's judgment is for, and so on, and that becomes a self-perpetuating group. I've seen it on all kinds of boards where they pick the board members and do all of that, and I don't think that's an appropriate function of a board, is to make recommendations of who's going to take their place. I think that's inappropriate. I think that's up to the governor with perhaps confirmation of the Senate. And I've seen it on a lot of boards. The boards say who's going to take their place, and to me that's kind of what that's doing there. I think those recommendations should come from the governor's office and have the other people have some say-so on it.
Further discussion? Senator Hines.
Mr. Chairman, I had a comment and a question, and the comment was just made for me by the senator from Teton County. I agree with him completely on that. And then my question would go to page 14 on the Wyoming Trust Fund board creation and members. Am I missing, or is it somewhere else in the statutes where their duties are? I didn't find the duties, and I didn't look up in the statute. So are there duties listed somewhere else? Here we're just creating the fund board and telling who's going to be on it, but I didn't follow through to find out if those duties are listed somewhere else.
Senator Burns?
Mr. Chairman, the Cultural Trust Fund Board is only mentioned in this legislation because of line 13. This really has nothing to do with the Cultural Trust Fund Board, which is already established legislation. And amongst those who are appointed to the Cultural Trust Fund Board are two members who will be nominated by the Wyoming Arts Council Board as opposed to the Council of the Arts, or whatever we're changing it from, as opposed to the Council on the Arts. So it's just a language change. The Cultural Trust Fund Board, the Cultural Trust Fund Board already exists.
Further discussion on the bill? Seeing none, are you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Burns' motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 6, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Senate File 6 has passed Committee of the Whole. Next bill for our consideration is Senate File 52. Will the reading clerk please read the bill? Oops, sorry.
Senate File Number 52, sponsored by Senator Jennings, School Bus Seat Belts, an act relating to school buses. It was referred to Committee Number 4, Education, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Cole, DeCarrier, Jennings, Massey, Von Platter, and Senator Cole, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator Coe?
Mr. Chairman, when the Committee of the Whole rise and report, I move that it do so with a do pass recommendation on Senate File 52. There is a standing committee amendment, and I would move that standing committee amendment at this time and ask that it be read in.
It is on. Reading clerk, please read the amendment.
Senate File 52, standing committee amendment number 1, page 1, line 9.
Senator Coe?
Mr. Chairman, for an explanation of the standing committee amendment and the bill, I defer to Senator Jennings.
It's on here. What's on? Oh. Okay. Senator Jennings, and Senator Jennings, would you like to move the amendment? Or did Senator Coe move the amendment prior to the reading? Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Coe moved the amendment, but I'll move it again. I'll move the amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, with your, I'll go through the bill and then I'll come back and show you where the amendment goes in. This bill comes to us from the fifth grade class at Sagewood Elementary in Casper, Wyoming. And on a legislator day there, what I like to do with the kids is split them in into a Senate and a House and run through a bill. This usually takes about an hour. In this particular class of fifth graders, were sharp enough to understand what was going on. They did it in 40 minutes. So we had some time to kill, and I actually asked them, now that you know how to do this, is there a law that we should have in Wyoming? And a young man in the back of the class raised his hand and said, I think we need seat belts in our bus. So when I get in my mom's car, she says, fasten your seat belt. I feel safe. So when I get on the bus, there's no seatbelt, I don't feel safe. Because we were moving along so quick, I did not email you the two little short videos I was going to do, so I just explained them to you. One of them is a bus driving down the road, and it's the one that we heard about where the bus driver had a heart attack, and a young man came up and pushed the bus driver aside and stopped the bus. But as he was doing that, the bus is going down, and it hits some bumps off and on the road. And as you watch the video, you see in the very back of the bus, there's two kids that, when they hit a bump, fly completely out of their seats, hit the ceiling of the bus, and fall back down on the floor. The other thing that you should notice, if you want to watch these videos, is that as soon as something appears to be wrong, all the children stood up. So as we talk about these seats being compartmentalized. That has been the safety feature that we're supposed to have had in the buses. You got them all in these little compartments with the seat around them. But if when you look at a video like this and something goes wrong, they all stand up to see what it is. They're not in that compartment anymore. The second video, and these are both videos that were taken out of the discipline camera, I would guess, in the bus. Bus is driving down the road. A car pulls in front of it. The bus driver swerves to miss the car. The bus actually goes on its side, and the camera, because you can't see outside, the camera, doesn't show you that the bus is turned over. All it shows you is all of a sudden now all the kids that were sitting in one side of the bus, all you see are their little legs and feet sticking out of the seats on the other side of the bus. So what we have today in our buses really isn't doing the job every time you crash. Now, there's been some studies in the past about how we need to fix buses and whatnot. UCLA did a study years ago. They came up with this seat, and it had a number, and other people went and tested it. But one of the things that they forgot to put in the test was that the original seat, safety seat, called for a lap belt and some cushions around for back and forth stuff, and the testing left those out. It kind of befuddles me why, is that, you know, I look through the internet and I read all the stuff about it. Why did we go through so much effort to make sure that we didn't have seat belts in our buses? Now, just to give you an idea in your handout there, mine's in color, and I'll treasure this forever. This is the kids, this is a list of the kids in the class that when they got their hands on the bill, this is their message to you that they'd like to have seat belts in there. You'll also see another one from a company that has smaller buses, not school buses, that they run back and forth to the mines, and you'll notice in there that they went through quite a bit of evaluation so that they could finally get seat belts in their bus. But this is the handout that you have that should make the most difference, because what it shows is that you can put one kid in a seat, you can put three kids in a seat in the very same seat, you can put two big kids in it. Now, in the past, when school bus seatbelt bill came to us, and it's been a while before my time, we would have a gentleman out of the state education department come over and tell you all the reasons that you shouldn't have them. Basically, that the technology wasn't sufficient enough to keep the kids safe. Now, with this technology out, that same person came and testified in favor of the seatbelts. So if we go to the bill, you'll see what we're doing is that we want to establish that we're going to put seatbelts in the buses, and we've been guaranteed by the education department when they do their rules and choices on it, it will be this technology. As we go through, you'll see that the passengers shall wear their seatbelts properly secured at all times. Now, there's really not a way that you're going to tell every single kid in that bus, especially if it's one of those big 66-passenger buses, there's no way that the bus driver is going to look back there and make sure that every seatbelt is fastened. And I've had that comment made a couple times working on this bill. It's just like the bus driver can't turn back there and tell those kids you can't fight and make sure that every single kid on the bus doesn't fight. Or it's the same way that if you tell them they can't scream and holler at each other. This is a discipline problem that's going to have to be dealt with as a discipline problem. And I wouldn't want to get into the local control and tell the districts on how to do it. Just saying they're going to have to do it. As you look in page 2, line 7, what we're trying to do as we go through here is not go back and retrofit all the buses. Matter of fact, we had testimony in the committee meeting that it would not be a good idea to try to retrofit a bus, because that meant taking out seats that were there, leaving holes in the body of the bus, and then drilling new holes to put the new ones in. And we're actually told that that would weaken certain areas of the bus. So that the best way to do this is as we phase the bus out and we order a new one, we order it with factory-installed seat belts or this new technology that includes a seat and everything. As we go through a little bit more, you'll see that on line 20, that what we've done here is we've taken away or we've emphasized that if a bus driver's driving the bus, something happens, a child doesn't have his seatbelt on, that's not admissible as a civil action. Again, how the bus driver says this is the rules, tells the kids to do them. If a kid doesn't have a seatbelt on, the bus rolls or has an accident. You can't hold the bus driver responsible because a kid won't obey the rules. As you go back, you'll see on page 3, and this is the area where the amendment will come in. So, Mr. Chairman, if we can, we can go to the amendment. And if you look on the first page of the amendment, what we've done here is we've tried to take one more step on the bus driver, because if we leave the bill the way it is without the amendment, it basically says if the bus is pulled over by the highway patrol or the sheriff, and the sheriff or the highway patrol wants to make a pass through the bus, and the kid doesn't have a seatbelt on, the driver gets the ticket for it. Well, again, this is one of those things that's going to be a discipline issue. You're going to have to address it as a discipline issue, and it wouldn't really be fair to the bus driver to give them a ticket because the kid won't put a seatbelt on. Now, if you've got a kid that won't wear a seatbelt, I would imagine that the school district would probably tell mom and dad, you get to take him to school, and then you can see if he wears a seatbelt in your car or your truck. There, the driver would get the fine if the kid didn't have the seatbelt on. But in today's society, where we tell our kids to get in the car and buckle their seatbelts, we're just sending that wrong message back to them. We tell them to get in the school bus, and there isn't one. So as you go through the amendment, Mr. Chairman, you'll see that line 14, well, first of all, we went back and we no, we didn't. As you see, we rearranged the section there, and we put in what the section does not apply to. And you'll see some current language in there, but then you'll go down and you'll see that on the second page of the amendment that they're exempt from, the bus driver is exempt from the law that says if they're pulled over and the kid doesn't have a seatbelt on, that the bus driver would get the ticket. So, Mr. Chairman, that is the bill in a nutshell. You've got this coming right from the kids themselves, saying that they don't feel safe in it. You've got the Education Department finally coming in, say the technology's there. We didn't go back and try to retrofit 1,800 buses. So as the buses circulate through, it'll probably take us eight to 10 years, maybe a little bit longer. And at that time, everybody will have seat belts, and they'll all know how to fasten them. Mr. Chairman, I stand for questions.
Discussion on amendment, Standing Committee Amendment Number 1. Senator Bebout.
Question on amendment. I had on the bill.
We have an amendment on the floor, Senator Bebout. So. On the amendment, Senator Ross.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question on the amendment, which is on the violations. I thought it was my understanding, and I stand corrected if I'm wrong, but I thought that the current state of the law was that you could not cite some motor vehicle for failure to wear a seatbelt as the pretext or the reason in which you stopped a vehicle, that they had to have done something else, and then subsequent to that, if they didn't have their seatbelt on, they could ticket them. So I'm wondering, in this situation, when you have so many people on the bus, it's going to be nearly impossible, it would seem to me, for a law enforcement to know whether or not the children had their seatbelt on or not. The other thing, my other concern is that when we, in an effort to transport our kids to sporting events all over the state, attempt to save money, and this happens with my daughter all the time, who travels with Central basketball team, to save money rather than stay overnight after their second game, they pile in the bus and it's late. And these kids are tired. They you know, they bring their pillows, their blankets with them, and they sleep on these buses on the way home. And I'm not certain that they can do that in this situation if they've got to be buckled in. Now, maybe it's in their best interest to be buckled in, but then I'm going to suggest that maybe school districts are going to have to start staying overnight more to accommodate these children if they're going to be sitting upright in a bus travel these late hours. I guess it's a judgment call on what we want to do here, but I'm concerned about the practicality of the whole situation. I don't dispute that technology may have gotten to the point where now they can fit these buses, these new buses, with these belts, but whether or not we're actually solving the purpose. And it would seem to me that if we're going to do that, we need to take care of these kids by letting them stay the night after a ball game, and you just about bumped up school districts' costs dramatically. I'm wondering about, first of all, this whole idea of citing them. We certainly give the bus driver the ability to tell them he's got to wear these, but I'm not sure how law enforcement is even able to comply or to even know how to enforce subsection F of the amendment.
Senator Jennings.
Mr. Chairman, I agree on the first part of what the good senator from Cheyenne brought up. Right now, it is the practice, and when the gentleman from state education heard of the practice, he wanted to cover his ears and start going, no, 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 so he couldn't hear it. It is the practice in many of these buses for the kids to grab their pillows and start sacking out wherever they can. That may or may not be right. If we put seat belts in there, make them available to them, it will not be right. Now, I can remember years ago when my employment took me overseas. I spent 15 hours on an airplane, and I was in that seat, and my favorite pillow was that little one that went around your head. And you could either find one that had funny little beads in it or blow it up. And most everybody that traveled that way all had one of those little pillows that kept you from getting a stiff neck, because you didn't have a seat. You didn't have a place to go lay down on the floor or something like that, and it kept you in your seat, in your seatbelt. It can be done. Will it be an inconvenience to the way that they're doing it now? Yeah, probably will. Now, as far as the law enforcement side of it, we have actually heard testimony in the committee that it would be, first of all, they wouldn't do it. That if for some reason or other the bus was pulled over, and the testimony was that they're worried more about people passing the bus than they are what the bus is doing. But if a bus was pulled over, then we were told that generally what happens is they look at the situation. If the driver doesn't have their belt on, then they usually get a ticket. If the car is full of people of the same age or peer group, very seldom does the driver get a ticket, and everybody that doesn't have a seatbelt on gets a ticket. If the driver is responsible for the people in the car, then they would get a ticket. All this was an agreement by the committee that rather than taking that as this is the policy today that's handed out throughout Highway Patrol, that it may not be the policy of a county sheriff or whatever, just go ahead and cover it. We also heard testimony that if the bus drivers who get paid less than $20,000 a year hear that they're going to be liable for all this stuff, one school district superintendent said, I can't hire any more bus drivers. So this is to accommodate that testimony request. It most likely there would not be a citation. Now we're saying there won't be a citation.
Further discussion on the amendment? Senator DeVivo.
Mr. Chairman, I do have a question on the amendment. Just from the structure of the way it's written, I want to be sure there's no conflict. If you look at the existing proposed bill on page 2, we talk about that the operator to require passenger wear lap or seatbelt as required under Wyoming statute 3115-402A shall not be admissible in any civil action. Okay, we say that on page 2. Then if we vote for the amendment, we're changing and only, you know, A becomes part of 315-1402, and then we add at the end of a G, which talks about, again, the shall not be admissible in any civil action language under subsection G. Is there any conflict in those two, the way they're written? Because one refers to A only, and then the other one is in that subsection, but refers to the Act.
Further discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, you ready for the question? All in favor of Senator Coe's motion to adopt the Standing Committee Number 1 to Senate File 52 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay?
No.
The motion to adopt Standing Committee Amendment Number 1 has passed. We're back on the bill. Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, if I could ask a question that specifically comes on page 3. Well, I guess it goes to the bill itself. On page 3, it says, and before that, after July 1st, 2009, the way I read this, every bus that a school district orders will have to have seatbelts on it. So does that ban any school districts from buying any used school buses?
Senator Jennings?
Mr. Chairman, yes. Buy, rent, or lease. And the smaller ones, these are for the, I believe it's the A buses is what we're calling these, the big, you know, type A's. The smaller buses already have seat belts in them. So those really aren't under this. So after that date, as we rotate buses out, which is either, I can't remember the miles, but it's either a certain number of months or a certain amount of miles that the bus is automatically rotated out of the fleet and a new one's brought in. At that point, when the new bus is ordered, it'll be ordered with factory-installed seatbelts.
Senator Perkins?
Yes, I do have a question, I guess two questions. One would be, do we have, is this proposal that we would install seatbelts on a 66-seat passenger bus, would there be 66 seatbelts on that or only the 5 or 6 for the kids who actually I see riding on the bus in the morning? That's kind of question one. The other one touches on a related issue, but I was just wondering if there was testimony from any individual school districts that came and talked about this particular issue, or was this anywhere? Were there any particular school districts that came and testified, and what was the gist of their testimony?
Senator Jennings.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The only school districts that came and testified on the issue of taking the responsibility for the ticket away from the bus driver. Nobody that I can remember came in and testified against the idea. Now that the technology is to a level where it is, if it was just lap belts rather than the three-point, just like we have in our cars and trucks, if it was just lap belts, they'd be arguing against it. But with this current technology, that seats two large kids or three small kids in the same seat, and those places are available, whether we have 5 kids or 66 kids in each bus. They're there. They're easy to use. So that was the only thing that they had, was protect our bus drivers so that we can hire them without the threat of them getting a ticket.
Senator Burns.
Mr. Chairman, on page 2, paragraph C, the way I read that, anybody who undoes their seatbelt during the ride, the driver is liable for that? And is the technology to the point where the driver has some sort of board there so he can tell if a seatbelt's been undone or not?
Senator Jennings.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The amendment fixed that. And there, currently, there's some, I saw a couple places out there on the internet where they're toying with ideas that they'd have a panel and green light, red light on seats and stuff, but I'm not sure that that's technology that's really readily available or affordable. So.
Further discussion, Senator Esquivel.
Mr. Chairman, as I understand it, these buses are going to be equipped with seat belts on a rotation basis as they wear out or they reach the total number of miles that they're allowed to reach. I was just wondering, how are these buses going to be assigned within the districts? And I guess my concern would be that that there might be some districts that might not be given as much preference as maybe some other districts. I was wondering how this rotation might work out.
Senator Jennings.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The rotation is district by district. It's not state. You know, the state, it's not all the buses in the state. It's all the buses in a district. And there's a certain number of miles or years. And I'm sorry, I can't remember what it is, but it's the same for every bus in the state. So if you have 10 buses in one district and you have 30 buses in the next district, it's the number of miles the bus has traveled or the number of years it's been in service that chooses whether it gets rotated or not. So if you have a bus that has a high mileage area, then that bus would probably be changed out quicker on the miles than it would be the years. So it really doesn't make any difference of where it is or how it gets changed out, because it's all the same across the state by district. The other thing was, as it was mentioned, that most likely the buses with the seat belts will be put out up front, and the older buses without seat belts will probably get rotated back to reserve.
Senator Vasey?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. And if the bill sponsor could guide me through the timing of this, and I could be wrong, but it's going to, if this bill passes and goes forward, it's going to be July 1st of 2009. How does that fit in with the budgeting of the school year? And I know that $1.2 million is chump change to the education, but I just wondered about the whole budgeting process, whether this could be done, and if it can't with the school district, are they going to push this buying and recycling of buses back a while until they can? This probably is well thought out, but I have a question. I can't quite get my arms around the time of this.
Senator Jennings.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It was brought up in testimony that someplace out there in the southern part of the state lost several buses, and would it be in time if it passed to replace those 8 or 9 buses? And those buses have already been ordered and in place. All it does is it say ordered. So by July 1, 2009, from then on, when they order a bus, they'll order it with seat belts. We reimburse them 100% on transportation. So as far as the school district needing to go out and budget, it's not them that has to budget, it's us. So that we, on our reimbursements back to them, is where we'll see it come back. It won't be in the school district's budget at all.
Further discussion, Senator Ross?
A couple of questions just on the practicality here. I'm unfortunately not privy to the little, to your handout, and I don't know what these really look like, but I'm understanding the testimony here today is that these buses will have 3 of them per side of the bus, per row or whatever, so to speak. And if there's 2 large people, they'll just use 2, but there will be a third one if there's a third, or do they have to double up with another student? Secondly, are the seats any different than what we currently see in a bus? Because if they're not, they don't even come up to head high on those buses. For instance, if you're in an airplane, you have the three-point harness, you have, or you just have a lap belt in an airplane, but you have a seat that generally the headrests come out somewhat so you can, you can keep your head from falling over a little bit. And generally, sometimes I've had that great fortune of sleeping on somebody else's shoulder, but generally uncomfortable situation unless you'd really know them. But I'm just wondering about the practicality of the whole dang thing. I mean, it seems to me that it's well intentioned, but if we're really going to do it, and we're going to do it, we got to do it right for these kids, particularly these kids that got to travel at 1 a.m. in the middle of the night trying to get back from a sporting event, because we have to travel long distances in the state of Wyoming. I just seriously wonder if that's if we're really spending our money wisely here, and this is $1.2 million, but if we're going to do it right, we ought to be spending a whole lot more money in these buses.
Senator Landon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I've got an idea as to the rotation and the way these buses within districts are going to be scheduled out. And so I'd have a little bit of an answer to our colleague from Laramie County. And it would be this, and this is in line with the thinking of our other senator from Laramie County, and that is that the varsity teams are going to be those that get the buses with no seat belts. They'll be able to take their pillows, and they'll get those buses, and then the JV teams are the ones that are going to get the seat belts. So that answers your question over there. You know, I have to agree with the good senator from Laramie County, and having had a lot of experience in this area, getting home at 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning from distances as far away as Glendive and Trinidad, Colorado, I too wonder about the practicality of what we're talking about here, and It's kind of like being in a position of voting against apple pie here. I mean, we are talking about safety of people in these buses, but the practicality of it has me really conflicted.
Senator Johnson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I remember the days that my daughter went to the speech meets all over Wyoming and the surrounding states, and my worry wasn't her as much as it was the driver who picked up that bus at 4 a.m. in the morning, and they're probably going to get back at 4 a.m. the next morning, and it's the same driver, and guess how much rest he or she hasn't had.
Senator Sessions.
Mr. Chairman, I guess this dates me. Back a while, when we discussed seat belts on school buses before, those, and some of you may remember, the seats were those low seats that hit probably with the child right in the middle of their neck, right in back there. That was when it was absolutely the worst thing in the world you could do, was to put a child in a restraint in those because of the injuries to the head. And at that time, even, I think that was all that was discussed were the lap belts. Now, if you look at a new bus, you've got the seats that come up high, just like your airplane seats do, that cushion that child's head like that, and they're pretty plush, actually, you might, compared to the old ones that you clunked around on. But so you've got the shoulder strap, the seat strap, and you have the protection for the head at the same time. And so, it's a policy call, I guess. I had children travel all over this state, over South Pass several times a year and the whole bit, and I would have loved to have had them in a seatbelt, on those buses in the middle of the winter when you couldn't see either side of the road, and that did happen, and they could sleep when they get home.
Further discussion? Senator Coe.
No, Mr. Chairman. I was here for the debate when we talked about the seat belts before,
and the
department. Senator Coe, could I have you aim your microphone at you a little bit? Thank you.
How's that better?
Yes.
And the same director of transportation at the department was there then. He gave pretty extensive testimony in committee. He now buys into the new technology. Now, the handout wasn't able to be put out in time. You can see the seats right here. And this little guy here in the middle looks like the senator from Laramie County when he was little. And cute. But anyway, it's called the Safeguard Flex Seat. I don't know if you talked about this or not. Features lap shoulder belt protection, full compartmentalization, eliminates costs associated with reduced bus capacity. Flexible capacity enables belted seating for one, two, or three children or two larger kids. So actually, I was impressed with the testimony. I went into the discussion of the bill with the idea that I might not support it from what we went through before. And that had to do, if a bus goes upside down, the kid might not be able to undo his seatbelt and get out. And actually, with the triple latch stuff they have now, it's easy. But I came out of the testimony in favor of proceeding with this. And when I started, I was a little bit skeptical. But I would urge that you pass this bill. It phases it in. It's going to take a while. It's going to be about 100 buses a year. The director of the patrol was there and made the comments. They want people belted in no matter what they're in now. And why wouldn't we do it for kids? So I'd urge that you pass the bill.
Further discussion. Further, Senator Schiffer.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Was there any discussion during this transition time, as some school buses have belts and some don't, is there any liability on the part of a school district when they put a child in a bus that does not have seat belts and they know that there are other buses that are more safer, and as they transition, is there a liability if a child gets hurt in a non-belted bus during the transition?
Senator Jennings.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That question was actually presented prior to the meeting, and we addressed it in the committee meeting. And again, when we go back and talk about retrofitting buses, they highly advise not to, because it actually weakens the bus. And the gentleman out of the transportation, out of the state education department, described it as, if you have a 2009 pickup truck that has all the latest and greatest safety features in it, and somebody else over here has the 2000 truck that doesn't have them all, that it's the same idea as when technology becomes available, you use it. If it's not available in those later models, it wasn't in later models. Some of us can remember back to when there were no seat belts in anything. And then we got the old lap belt, and then now we have the 3-point. So they explained it the same way: as technology becomes available, you do it. Will somebody, if the situation arises, try to cash in on that? Probably. But it's a decision then, do we do the whole fleet at once, or do we phase them in? And the transportation department, education department, felt comfortable with phasing them in.
Follow up, Senator Schiffer.
And Mr. Chairman, to follow up on the same issue, and should there be a liability amendment put in this bill that until they do get transitioned, and I believe it's in a civil proceeding, do school districts need relief from that liability?
Further discussion, Senator Scott.
Mr. Chairman, following on the last, or is the state and school district sufficiently immune on the sovereign immunity things? That's not an issue. I've been listening to this debate carefully, and what I was expecting to hear was some evidence of the need for these belts and the harm that was being done by the lack of them, and I haven't heard that yet. When we've debated the seatbelt law for cars, when we've debated motorcycle helmets, we heard quite a bit about how the situation without them was dangerous and how the seat belts were potentially going to save lives. And I would imagine the same debate applies to the smaller buses that are very much like passenger cars. When we debate the smoking bill, we'll hear about the reduction in heart attacks that you can get with it. What I haven't heard with this is the evidence that these bigger buses are dangerous without the seat belts, and the evidence of the good that the seat belts will do that would justify the cost. And, Mr. Chairman, that's the question I have on the bill. Is it a feel-good that's going to spend a lot of money without accomplishing anything, or is it something that is meeting a real need out there that we simply haven't had the good technology to deal with until now, and now that we've got it, we'll actually save some kids and really protect our kids better in these larger buses?
Further discussion, Senator Jennings?
In Wyoming, because of the smaller population, and we did have some numbers presented to me, and I will get those to you. I'm sorry that I left them in my notebook in the committee room. But we did have some numbers presented in Wyoming. The two things that we're faced with here on this is, with the number of miles that we do, we've been lucky so far that we haven't rolled, like the good senator from Cheyenne said, her kids going over South Pass. We haven't rolled a bus, and we haven't seen the little legs sticking out of the seat as it goes over. And I'll get you the link to that video so you can watch that. We've been lucky. We've had a few accidents. When you look at what's the safest vehicle on the road today, absolutely is the school bus. And with the seats that they're building now that don't have the seat belts in them, the little compartments that they're trying to put you in, it's pretty safe. When the higher backs, if you're in a collision and you go forward, you get the seat in front of you catches your head right there as you hit it. The lap belt, seat belt would keep you from doing that. The biggest problem is with the older kids, as you could see in this video, as an accident or something up there caught their attention, like the bus driver that had the heart attack, the first thing they did was stand up to look and see what was happening. The smaller kids in the other one, same type of thing. Once that car pulled out in front of that school bus, then the driver of the bus tried to not hit the car. Some of those kids were looking up. And the minute that happens, that takes them out of that safety zone that they're in. So do we have a rash of deaths and injuries in Wyoming? Not yet. We also heard in testimony that the transportation bus officials throughout the nation have been asking the federal government for the guidelines of what do we do for buses. And they didn't get them for years. Now they have them. And he held them up, and it was a book about this thick. And it's coming down the pike sooner or later. Now that they have them, sooner or later, we're going to do this anyway. If we're already into the program, then maybe that we'll buy off that we're doing the gradual change. If we're not, we may get one of those mandates that said next year all your buses will be converted. So one way or another, sooner or later, we're going to have to address it anyway. And to answer your question, yes, we've got kids hurt in Wyoming. I'll get you the numbers, but we don't have hundreds of kids hurt in Wyoming.
Further discussion? Senator Dockstader.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just quickly then, if this is going on across the nation, are there some states across the nation that have already implemented this program?
Senator Jennings.
This technology being very new, there's a handful that have. Off the top of my head, I believe California was one. There's a couple out on the East Coast that have. And I think maybe Texas just did. But this is new technology. I talked to a lady that actually works for a national school bus magazine, and she said at all the trade shows, these seats, this technology is what everybody's talking about. So if we do this, once again, Wyoming would be on the front edge of doing something, but they're doing it, and it's slowly but surely the rest of the states will come around.
Further discussion?
Seeing none, you ready for the question? All those in favor of Senator Coe's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 52, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no?
No.
Senate File 52 has passed the Committee of the Whole. The next bill for our consideration is Senate File 45. Will the reading clerk please read?
Thank you.
Senate File Number 45, sponsored by Senator Cooper, Improvement and Service District Directors, an act relating to improvement and service districts. It was referred to Committee Number 9, Minerals Business Economic Development, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Bebout, Cooper, Honeycutt, Larson, and Martin. Senator Larson, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What's your pleasure, Senator Larson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move when the Committee of the Whole rise to report it do so with a favorable recommendation, and I'd like to call on Senator Cooper.
Senator Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Fellow Senators, Senate 45 was mentioned, improvement and service district directors. This bill began as a request from the Eden Valley Improvement District in Farson, which is in my district, because they felt that they just needed to be able to have some more members of their local improvement district board. It's a small community there, and they're being particularly impacted by, of course, the Jonah Field and the Pinedale Anticline there in the area. And they're doing quite a few little projects there in their community, and they'd like to have some more people be involved in their in the process. I go through the bill now. Page 1, line 15, this is the change that, of course, will allow the districts the option of going from either 3 to 5 managing directors. And by the way, the bill does allow, too, that if they have 5 directors and later want to go back to 3, they can do that, too. But whatever they do has to occur in an election by the general electorate. Page 1, line 16, and page 2, line 1, this permits the initial board, as I said, to have either 3 or 5 members. Page 2, lines 2, 3, 4, and 5, this allows a simple majority of the initial organizational board, it means when they first formed the board, to be elected for 2 years, and then the remaining members to be elected for 4 years, which provides for the continuity through the staggered terms of the board, and eventually, of course, all the members will become have 4-year terms. And also deletes the language of the old 5-year term. Page 2, lines 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12, there deletes the old language of the 5-year terms. And then on page 2, line 13, it adds in and talks about the language for, of course, the 4-year term. And then page 2, lines 18 through 24, and page 3, lines 1 through 11, provide the language for the election to increase or decrease the number of directors, as I mentioned originally. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I stand for questions.
Discussion on the bill. Senator Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question for the sponsor. I'm just wondering if you have any background about what is why 3 or 5, why not 7 or 9, why would we determine how many directors one of these folks should have, and if they want to have 7, why shouldn't they have 7? I just wondered if there's any discussion about that, or if there's any, some kind of history or magic associated with these particular numbers.
Senator Cooper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The reason for the 4-year term is to be able to use the general election ballot for this. With the problem with the board's terms now is that when you elect them, like a 3-member board, for example, They're elected on a 3-year, 4-year, and a 5-year term. And after the first 3 years, you're having an election every year practically. I mean, there's one space in between them, but because the third year term is up, the fourth year, the fifth year. And what happens is they end up having to have mail-in ballots, I guess you call them. And it's very expensive to these little districts. Some of these little districts, they don't get paid anything. None of the board members, Mr. Chairman, get paid anything at all for this. They just do it voluntarily. These boards don't have mill levies. They're just usually used to be able to retire debt for a bond issue. And so it's a pretty costly proposition for them to be able to do all these, constantly have these mail-in ballots. Another thing is, for the 4-year term, if it goes on the general election ballot, usually people pay a little bit more attention to it. A lot of people, the electorates in these improvement districts, sometimes don't pay attention to the mail-in ballots, and they'd like to have a little bit more participation in that part. And then about the number of the members. No, I don't know that that's you could have 7 members, 9 members, whatever. But there's we have many boards in the state that have 5 members, 3 members. I guess the idea is, the only thing I could think of as far as that goes would be, that was the request that I got from the district and the letter that they sent me and the discussions we had in the meeting. And also, it's probably has to do, you know, you like to have the odd member so you could have, so you don't always have a tie vote, in other words, so it eliminates the tie vote situation. And that's about the only thing I can think of, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think when I moved that bill, I inadvertently didn't say the number of the bill. I just wanted to make it clear I was moving Senate File 45 for due pass.
Thank you for your clarification. Any additional discussion on the bill? Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Larson's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report that it do so with a favorable recommendation on Senate File 45, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Senate File 45 has passed the Committee of the Whole. Our next Senate file for consideration is Senate File 70. Would the clerk please read the bill?
Senate File 70, sponsored by Senator Case, Loss of Firearm Rights Protections, an Act Relating to Crime and Criminal Procedures. It was referred to Committee Number 1 Judiciary, reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Burns, DeCaria, Perkins, Ross, and Sessions, Senator Ross, Chairman.
You've heard the reading of the bill. What is your pleasure, Senator, or Vice President Ross?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that when the Committee of the Whole rise and report it, do so with a due pass recommendation on Senate File 70. There are no standing committee amendments, and would yield the floor to the good senator from Fremont County.
Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I stand here with Senate File 70. It's Loss of Firearm Rights Protections. You know, Wyoming has had a bit of history. We've tried to develop our own way to make sure that there was a mechanism by which folks convicted of a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence, which meets the definitions in the United States Federal Code under the Brady Act, could someday get their firearms rights back. And several years ago, we passed a law that allowed for the ability to expunge the record of a misdemeanor criminal after there had been an intensive investigation and the court ruled that it was warranted to give the firearms rights back. Well, we went to court with the feds on this one, and we lost. There really does not seem to be a way to satisfy the federal government unless you go back in and actually expunge the record of someone convicted of a misdemeanor crime. Or you could grant them a pardon. But neither one of those is a very satisfactory route to go. The expungement, the problem with the expungement is if you remove the record, then if they're a repeat offender, Mr. Chairman, a really bad apple, that expungement removes that record so you never know that they're a bad apple. So what can we do? Because it really is a terrible situation in that you can lose a federal or a United States constitutional right. The Second Amendment guarantees your right to keep and bear arms. You can lose those rights for a misdemeanor crime. Now, this is not any, domestic violence is a horrible plague that we need to stop in any way that we can. Wyoming statutes provide for misdemeanor convictions, and sometimes they're very minor situations. They are not always very minor situations, and people are killed with firearms, and this is not about that. This is about misdemeanor crimes, where you lose your constitutional right to keep and bear arms for a misdemeanor. And it can be simple as two brothers getting in a bit of a shoving match on the back porch of the house. Okay. We need to take these misdemeanor crimes very seriously because under Wyoming law, we have Wyoming penalties. But these crimes trigger federal penalties. And so people need to be advised of their rights. That's what this bill does. It has two sections. The first section says, before a person is allowed to enter a plea, they must be advised that they could be subject to losing their firearms rights. Now, there's people, you know, there's about probably three different kinds of people that are involved with firearms. Some people could care less if they lose their firearms rights. They don't hunt. They don't care about guns. Doesn't matter. Some people care very much. They love to hunt. They love to sport shoot. It's important to them. Other people, it's absolutely essential because it affects their job. Some of those people are active military. If you want to lose your ability to serve in the United States Armed Forces and be a member of our National Guard, get in with a shoving match with your brother on the back porch of the house and get convicted of misdemeanor crime of domestic violence. That's where the second section of this area comes in, really, Mr. Chairman, is that it says, you know, this is a very serious crime. The loss of a constitutional right is a serious penalty. You know, we define a misdemeanor as less than a year in jail. But loss of a constitutional right is also a very serious consequence. So this goes into the public defender statute in Section 2 of this bill and says, if the a serious crime includes a crime where you stand to lose this fundamental right to carry a firearm. And in that case, you have to be advised that you're entitled to an attorney and that if you can't afford one, one will be appointed to supply advice to you. That's the essence of the bill. It was supported by everyone that testified in the committee, including a group well-known in Wyoming and very well thought of that protects families against the issues of domestic violence. The governor's office sent a gentleman, well-known person that's been involved in the military and has served as a staff advisor to the governor to testify in favor of this bill. So I don't know anybody that's against this bill, and all it does is say you need to be advised of the consequences of your plea because this is a very serious penalty that that will be imposed on you. Be happy to answer any questions.
Questions on the bill? No questions on the bill? Are you ready for the question? Thank you. Question being called. All those in favor of Senator Ross's motion that when the Committee of the Whole rises to report, that it do so with a favorable recommendation of Senate File 70, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Senate File 70 has passed Committee of the Whole. The next Senate file for our consideration is Senate File 19. Would the clerk please read the file?
Senate File Number 19, sponsored by the Mental Health Committee, Cost of Emergency Detention and Hospitalization, an Act Relating to Emergency Detention and Involuntary Hospitalization Costs. It was assigned to Committee Number 1 Judiciary. Reports back with a favorable recommendation that it do pass amended. Aye, Senators Burns, DeCarrier, Perkins, Ross, and Sessions. Senator Ross, Chairman.
Vice President Ross, you've heard the bill. What's your pleasure?
Mr. Chairman, may I have the privilege of the floor for a moment?
Granted.
Mr. Chairman, before I move this bill, or there is a standing committee amendment, and I don't believe that it has been distributed yet. So I don't know what the proper procedure would be, but I have it only because I'm the chairman of the committee.
Mr. Floor Leader, would you like to take the next bill and put this one underneath it?
I think they're distributing it.
And with that, Mr. Chairman, I will make the motion. I move that the Committee of the Whole rise and report.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Reading Senator Jennings.
Mr. President, I move the Committee of the Whole.
Got to read it first.
The reading clerk needs to read the Committee of the Whole report.
Mr. President, your Committee of the Whole, having had under consideration bills on general file, begs leave to report as follows. Senate File 4, do pass. Senate File 61, do pass amended. Senate File 29, do pass. Senate File 12, do pass. Senate File 33, do pass amended. Senate File 7, do pass. Senate File 2, do pass amended. Senate File 35, do pass. Senate File 76, do pass. Senate File 6, do pass. Senate File 52, do pass, amended. Senate File 45, do pass. Senate File 70, do pass. Senator Jennings, Chairman.
Senator Jennings.
Now, Mr. President, I would like to move for the adoption of the Committee of the Whole report.
You heard the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion passed. Messages from the House.
January the 19th, 2009, from the House of Representatives. Message number 6. Mr. President, this is to inform you that the House has adopted the temporary House and joint rules of the 60th Wyoming State Legislature as a permanent rules of the 60th Wyoming State Legislature with the attached amendments. Dispensing with the reading, Patricia L. Benskin, House Chief Clerk.
Standing committee reports.
January the 19th, 2009, Mr. President, your committee number 9, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, to whom was referred Senate File 90, reports back with the recommendation that it do pass. Aye, Senators Bebout, Cooper, Honeycutt, Larson, and Martin. Senator Larson, Chairman.
As a reminder, if you have If you attended any of the training session on Monday, January 12th, a week ago, and you haven't signed the per diem acknowledgement form in the main LSO office, room 213, you need to stop by as soon as possible so the they can go ahead and process the payment by this Wednesday. Mr. Majority Floor Leader, that clears the desk.
Thank you, Mr. President. And before I make the necessary motion, I would just like to say to the body, good progress this afternoon. We're all kind of getting some of the kinks out and getting back into the movement of things. And I would like to say to staff how much I appreciate your efforts in helping us getting started. So, Mr. President, I think an excellent start. And I also, Mr. President, move that the Senate stand adjourned until 10 o'clock tomorrow morning.
Senator Coe.
Mr. President, your committee number four, Education, meet tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock over here in S11 by the Smoking Lounge to hear Senate File 89, Fallen Heroes Scholarships, Senate File 91, Driver Licensing and School Enrollment, and Senate File 100, Public School Nurse Appropriations.
Senator Geis.
Mr. President, your committee number five, Agriculture, Public Land, and Water Resources, Tuesday night upon adjournment, we'll take up Senate File 34, beginning Agriculture Producer Finance Authority, Senate File 69, Fertilizers, Senate File 32, Wyoming Livestock Health and Emergency Disease Program, Senate File 36, Intentional Feeding of Elk, Senate File 8, Feral Livestock.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your committee number nine, Minerals, Business, and Economic Development, will meet immediately on adjournment up in S18 to continue the meeting we had at noon, but to take up Senate File 92, Long-Term Care Access.
Senator Von Flederman.
Thank you, Mr. President. Your committee number eight, Transportation, Highways, and Military Affairs, will meet in about the top of the hour, 10 minutes from now, on S13 to go over Senate File 74, Youthful Drivers Restricted Licenses, Senate File 38, Real ID Compliance, and Senate File 60, National Guard Youth Challenge Program.
Senator Case.
Thank you, Mr. President. We are going to have a meeting tonight on Senate File 72, the Corporations Act Amendments. We'll probably spend about an hour. We'll get started at 5 o'clock, and we have to get started. It's a huge bill. Might be the biggest one you've ever seen in the legislature, and it'll be an S-19 in about 10 minutes.
Majority Floor Leader Anderson.
Mr. President, just as a reminder, sometimes in our busy schedules, we don't look at our mail. You have just recently had handed out on LSO letterhead a letter that's signed by the President, Senator Hines, as well as Representative Colin Simpson, the Speaker of the House. I will not detail this letter at this time, but I think it's important that you pull it out and read it in regard to the details that it does contain. Thank you, Mr. President.
You've heard the motion that the Senate stand adjourned until 10 a.m. tomorrow morning. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion passed. Senate adjourned.